hopes to come to be. And people gather around, they are brought what they can bring. I know about it when they act. I don't know the song to sing. The revolution starts now.
Good afternoon and welcome to Indie Media Live, one of the most progressive half hours on the radio, because we have no corporate sponsorship and no corporate control. I hope you'll stay tuned to hear what a difference that makes in bringing you the news. I'm your host, Rebecca Ferris, and I'm here every Tuesday introducing you to people who are passionately involved in the issues and causes that directly affect you and your family. We have a great show for you today. Professor Gary Francione is here. Distinguished legal philosopher, law professor from Rutgers University. We're going to be talking about animal rights issues, the abolitionist movement for animals. And before we jump into that conversation, I'm bringing you some of the important events from around the area. As you know, November 2nd is our general election. Voters still have through next Tuesday, October the 12th, to register for the upcoming election. And the American Civil Liberties Union of Virginia is distributing informational cards describing voters' rights, and they are urging voters to register before next Tuesday's deadline. If you'd like to contact the ACLU about the upcoming election, 644-8080, or you can call the State Board of Election right here in Richmond, 864-8901. If you're outside Richmond, toll free, 800-552-9745. The 7th District Congressional candidates, rather two of the three for the 7th District Congressional seat, will speak at a public forum next Monday night at 7 p.m., October the 11th, at the Tuckahoe Public Library, 1901 Starling Avenue, off Perham Road in Henrico. Appearing at the forum will be independent candidate Floyd Bain and Democratic candidate Rick Waugh. Congressman Eric Cantor was invited to participate but declined. Now I'd like to jump into our conversation with our guest today. Professor Gary Francione is an American legal philosopher. He is the Distinguished Professor of Law and the Nicholas B. Katzenbach Scholar of Law and Philosophy at Rutgers University. Professor Francione is also a pioneer of the abolitionist theory of animal rights. It's a real pleasure to speak with you today, Professor.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you, Rebecca.
You know, I had been a vegetarian for 37 years before I heard you being interviewed by Bob Linden on Go Vegan Radio. And your logic and your compassion changed me that day, July 21st, 2007, so profoundly that I actually divide my life now like historians divide history. You know how we do the BCE and the CE? For me, it's now BGF and SGF, you know, before Gary Francione and since Gary Francione. I just can't thank you enough for helping me understand the moral underpinnings of veganism, Gary.
Well, that's very kind of you to say, but, you know, that illustrates what I have been saying to animal advocates for a long time now, and that is people are really quite capable of understanding the vegan message if it's explained, and the vegan philosophy if it's explained coherently and clearly, and that the more we do things like promote vegetarianism, we have people who care about animals who will be vegetarians for, you know, 35, 37 years, and they won't go vegan because they think that they're discharging their moral obligations to animals simply by not eating meat, and they don't recognize that there's really no difference between milk and meat and eggs and whatnot. It's all animal torture. It's all unjustifiable. There's more suffering in a glass of milk than there is in a pound of steak. Dairy animals are kept alive longer. They're treated every bit as badly, and they all end up in the same slaughterhouse.
I know that you have visited, as hard as it's been for you over the years, slaughterhouses and dairy farms. And I wonder if you could tell us about that one particular day when you were at a dairy farm. And
yes, it was actually very, very early on. I visited an organic dairy farm when they were first becoming popular in New England. And this was a place where animals were supposed to be treated very well, and this was a happy exploitation place, which are now, you know, this was the sort of place that is being promoted by the large animal organizations in this country now, what I call the happy exploitation centers. And it was absolutely horrifying because I spent several days there, and the crying, the absolute distress and suffering of the mother cows when the baby cows were taken away. Actually, it was not just the male cows, but many of the female cows were also taken away. The babies, the calves, were taken away from their moms, and the really pathetic, horrible, soul piercing sort of cries of these animals. I was hearing this, and you know, I have to tell you, Rebecca, I still have nightmares of that experience. And when I was watching this and the time afterward that I had to reflect on it, I thought, you know, this is what they're telling us is the good situation. This is what people think of as the happy exploitation situation. And the bottom line is, there is no such thing as happy exploitation. It's all, you know, it's like putting padding on waterboards. It doesn't do anything. There is only one solution to the problem of animal exploitation, and that is to go vegan and to say no to violence against animals, to say no to the property status of animals, to say no to any level of violence against animals. None of it's necessary. We shouldn't be doing any of it. It's not a question of whether you torture them for 5 minutes or whether you torture them for 7 minutes. You shouldn't be doing it at all. And that veganism is really the only response, the only rational response.
I listened again to your interview from July 21st, 2007, last night.
Uh-huh.
And you were talking about the difference between dairy and the flesh.
Mm-hmm.
And you said the most amazing thing, that anybody who believes that there's a moral difference between steak and ice cream is deluding herself.
Absolutely.
And that was the line, Gary. That was the line that 3 years ago I said, well, I don't want to be deluding myself. That was the line that really helped me open my eyes. I had never, since I was a little kid, liked milk or eggs or butter. But I did eat cheese and yogurt. And I'm wondering if you can talk to us just a minute about that. Fact that veganism is not a lifestyle choice, it's not some extreme fringe position, but that it could be and hopefully will be the moral default position.
Well, you know, Rebecca, ironically, I think it's already the moral default position. We just don't think clearly about it, in large part because, again, ironically, The large animal organizations contribute very, very heavily to confusion in this area. Everybody believes, whether you're an animal advocate or not, if you're just a normal human being, you believe that it's wrong to inflict unnecessary suffering and death on animals. Now, as a matter of fact, I can't recall in my almost 30 years of doing this of ever meeting anybody who really disagreed with that. Now, we can have an interesting philosophical discussion about what necessity means, but we don't have to, because if it has any coherent meaning whatsoever, if the rule that we shouldn't inflict unnecessary suffering and death on animals means anything at all, if it has any coherent meaning at all, it means we can't inflict suffering and death for reasons of pleasure, amusement, or convenience. But when we look at our animal uses, 99.9999999% of them can only be justified by pleasure, amusement, or convenience. Let's take our largest use of animals, which is the use of animals for food, where we're killing 56 billion animals every year for food, not including fish and other aquatic animals. So we're talking probably close to 100 billion animals a year. We don't need to eat animals to lead an optimally healthy lifestyle. We simply don't. As a matter of fact, mainstream healthcare people are telling us more and more that animal products are detrimental for health. Animal agriculture is a complete ecological disaster. It's destroying the planet. The best justification we have, the only justification and the best justification we have for inflicting pain, suffering, and death on upwards of 100 billion animals a year is that they taste good. Now, it's interesting, this past weekend, the American football player Michael Vick was injured, and he was the fellow who was arrested and served prison time in connection with dog fighting. And there were a lot of animal advocates that were expressing happiness that he was injured. And I always find it disconcerting and sad when people express happiness that anybody is injured or hurt. But I found it ironic that so many animal people were saying, oh, Michael Vick, he's a terrible guy. I have news for you. There is no difference between Michael Vick and any non-vegan. Michael Vick likes sitting around watching dogs fight. Most people like sitting around the summer barbecue pit roasting corpses, or, you know, sitting around their television at night watching a movie, eating yogurt or, you know, ice cream or cheese pizzas or whatever they eat. And the bottom line is, just as Michael Vick could not justify what he did with those dogs, because he was inflicting suffering and death for reasons of pleasure and amusement, that's the same position every non-vegan is in. So before we start pointing fingers, moral fingers, at Michael Vick, maybe we got to think about what we're doing. And I think a good deal of the confusion, Rebecca, owes to the fact that large animal organizations promote vegetarianism as a coherent position. I mean, they're telling people, oh, yes, you know, you ought to go vegetarian. And they don't talk about, or they say, you know, they portray veganism as some sort of Herculean, a state of being that only the people who are really super committed, and, you know, it's sort of an optional thing. It's, you know, it's like what you do when you reach the stratosphere of animal advocacy or something. That's nonsense. It's easy to be a vegan, and animal organizations really ought to be promoting veganism as the moral baseline, because you really can't draw a distinction between flesh and other animal products. It's all the same. It's all the same. As a matter of fact, ironically, again, people who give up meat often increase their intake of dairy. And given that there is as much, if not more, suffering in dairy as there is in meat, you may actually be increasing that suffering. So you know, none of this really makes any sense. It's what I call the moral schizophrenia, the delusionary sort of way in which we think about animal issues. But you know, as I started my response off with the observation that in many ways veganism is the logical default position that we should be adopting, given that all of us agree that it's wrong to inflict unnecessary suffering and death.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Indie Media Live on WRIR. I'm Rebecca Ferris, and I'm having a conversation with American legal philosopher, Professor Gary Francione. He is the Distinguished Professor of Law and the Nicholas B. Katzenbach Scholar of Law and Philosophy at Rutgers University. Professor Francione is also a pioneer in the abolitionist theory of animal rights. Gary, you are also a prolific author. I know you have a new book coming out. Could we talk about the issue that are being discussed in your latest book?
Yeah, the latest book, which is published by Columbia University Press, is called The Animal Rights Debate, Abolition or Regulation. It was co-authored with Robert Garner, who's a political philosopher at the University of Leicester in Britain. And the book is a debate between Professor Garner and myself. The first part of the book, I argue that we ought to abolish animal use and that the regulation, animal welfare reform, simply doesn't work. It's wrong morally, but it also is a practical matter. It simply doesn't work. Animal welfare does nothing, and that's, if we have time, that's something we can return to. And then in the second part of the book, Robert discusses why he thinks that we should be promoting welfare reform, why we should be promoting cage-free eggs those sorts of measures. And then in the third part of the book, we actually debate. You know, we question each other and we provide answers, and, you know, we debate various topics. So that book will be out, I hope, either later this month or early in November. And I'm hoping that it will help people understand more. We have an intuitive attraction to animal welfare reform. You know, the idea is, well, you know, it's terrible, but you know, we've got to do something for animals now, and so let's support cage-free eggs, or let's support bigger cages, or let's support, you know, this measure, this welfarist measure, or that welfarist measure, this Proposition 2, or that, you know, gestation crate initiative, or whatever. And I don't think those measures do anything. I don't think they do anything. I don't think that they do anything to improve animal welfare at all, actually. I think that, again, the way I describe those measures is, at best, and I mean at best, they are like putting pads on waterboards, you know, in which you're going to waterboard people. You say, well, you know, it's better to have a pad on than to have a bare board. And the answer is, well, yes, but it's sort of insignificant at best. And I think that what those measures do is end up making people feel more comfortable about animal exploitation, and we're seeing that now. The number of people who are now happily eating animal products again because they believe that those animal products, you know, are being produced humanely, and because they have people like Peter Singer promoting the idea that we can that being a conscientious omnivore is a morally defensible position, or you have these large animal organizations which are actually supporting, and I find this very disturbing, Rebecca. They're actually supporting these humane labels. And so, you know, products, meat and animal products are being sold with labels that these are produced humanely, and where these labels are supported by these large animal organizations that people think of as animal rights organizations. They're not animal rights organizations at all. If an animal has any right at all, that animal has the right not to be treated as a resource. And I'm sorry, there is no way you can be eating the flesh or any products from an animal without regarding and treating that animal as a resource. That's what it's all about.
You have a very strong opinion about animal sentience as the foundation of an animal's rights.
Yes. There is a lot of debate going on now about, well, what sort of minds do animals have? And that is used, that is part of a discussion where there are people out there who are saying, well, to the extent that an animal thinks like us, then we have higher obligations to that animal. And my response to that is nonsense. What difference does it make how an animal thinks? We'll never really know. I will never really know. You'll never really understand what it is like to think like a dog or to be a bat or something like that, because their perceptual awareness is probably very different from our perceptual awareness. But my view is, as long as they have perceptual awareness, then they have that level of self-awareness that is needed. You see, Rebecca, it goes back to this idea which we've actually been dealing with for several hundred years, and that is, it's all right to use animals because they're not self-aware. We should treat them well, but it's all right to kill them and eat them or use them for our purposes because they're not self-aware. And my response to that is nonsense. That rests on a humanocentric conception of what self-awareness is. It basically, the assumption in that argument is the only way you can be self-aware is to have human-like self-awareness. And my response to that is nonsense. I mean, let's assume you have a human being who is severely mentally disabled. Now, would you treat that person differently from a person who has a normal level of intelligence? And the answer is yes. You might not give a driver's license to somebody who is severely mentally disabled, depending on what that person's functioning ability is. You might say, look, you know, your disability is so severe, we don't think you can safely drive a car. But for purposes of whether we're going to use either the normal human or the severely mentally disabled human as an unconsenting subject in a biomedical experiment or as a forced organ donor, what difference does the level of cognition make to the moral conclusion about what it is acceptable to do with those people? And my response to that is it doesn't make any difference whatsoever unless you want to buy into what I regard as a deeply disturbing, elitist, neo-Nazi view, actually, and I believe it is very much a neo-Nazi view, that people matter more for purposes of being used as a resource if they're more intelligent, that those who are more intelligent or more beautiful or more whatever, that they matter more, and that those who are less intelligent and less, you know, less well-educated or less beautiful or whatever, that they matter less for purposes of actually being treated as resources for the more beautiful and the more intelligent. I would hope most people would find that horrifying. And I think it's horrifying that we think of animals in that way, that this notion that, well, they have different minds from us, so therefore it's all right for us to eat them. The answer is they may have different minds from us, but that doesn't matter. All that matters is they're perceptually aware, they're sentient, they're able to feel pain, they're able to feel suffering, they're able to feel distress, they're able to feel fear. As long as they have perceptual awareness, as long as they're sentient, then we have no business. Their life matters to them, just like my life matters to you, your life matters, my life matters to me, your life matters to you. And it doesn't really matter how intelligent they are. I mean, this is part of this whole thing of it's speciesist, because what it's doing is just, it's erecting new speciesist lines and saying, well, that the non-human great apes matter more because they're like us, or dolphins matter more because they're like us, or whales matter more because they're like us. As far as I'm concerned, the whale has no greater moral value than does the dog, and we should not, or the fish, and we shouldn't be exploiting any of them.
If you've just tuned in, this is Indie Media Live, and we're talking with Gary Francione, legal philosopher, professor of law at Rutgers University, and we're talking about the abolitionist approach to animal rights. In fact, that's the name of your website, Gary, abolitionistapproach.com. Could you talk to us briefly about the mission statement that is on your website? It's just so well stated, I think.
The reason why I call it the abolitionist approach is because the concept of animal rights has become largely meaningless, because animal rights basically has now become synonymous with anybody who likes animals, you know, and who may eat lots of them, considers herself an animal rights advocate. And animal rights has really lost any sort of meaning. So what I try to do is focus on the fact that animal rights, if we're going to understand that concept, both as distinct from animal welfare and in its historical and how it developed historically, we have to focus on its abolitionist content. That is, the notion that we have no business using it. We cannot justify using animals, however humane our treatment of them is. We have no moral justification for using them. So what I've done with the abolitionist approach is to try to develop a theory, which I've been doing now for, I don't know, 20 some odd years now. It started in the early 90s. But the abolitionist approach focuses on the abolition of animal use, not the regulation of animal treatment. It requires only sentience, as I just mentioned. That, you know, in other words, for me, an animal is a full member of the moral community if the only characteristic that animal has is sentience. I don't require that the animal has cognitive characteristics which are similar to humans. I regard that as speciesist. It regards veganism as the moral baseline of the animal rights position. I mean, frankly, if you think animals matter, the first thing you do is you stop eating them, wearing them, using them. It's not the last thing that you do in a progression towards, you know, the Herculean state of veganism. If you take animals seriously, you stop eating them, wearing them, and using them. That's the first step you take, not the last one you take. And the abolitionist approach, as I've developed it in my work, rejects violence, rejects all sorts of violence. My view is violence is the problem, it's not the solution. That violence will only beget violence. And I also take the position that, as a practical matter, violence doesn't work. There are some people out there who advocate that we ought to use violence. I think it's silly. You can burn down 10 slaughterhouses today, and if the demand remains the same, then those 10 slaughterhouses will pop up someplace else, or 10 existing slaughterhouses will increase their production capacity. So the bottom line is, as far as I'm concerned, that violence is the problem, it's not the solution. And, if violence was the solution to anything, Rebecca, we'd all be living in the Garden of Eden, because the history of humankind is the history of violence. And so if violence worked, we'd all be living in a peaceful world now, and we're not. Violence begets violence. It's wrong morally, and it's wrong as a practical matter. And so that's an important part of my approach to animal rights. I maintain that what we ought to engage in is creative, nonviolent vegan education. If the only thing I do in the next year, other than be a vegan myself, is educate one other person to be a vegan, and then that person the following year educates one person, then I educate another person, and then we map it out in terms of the number of vegans that we'll have in another 8 to 10 years, we'll have a vegan world. So really, all we need to do is to engage in creative, nonviolent vegan education, and we can shift the paradigm. We can move the paradigm in the direction of animals as persons and away from the notion of animals as property, which is what we have to do if we ever want to see justice for animals.
In the last few minutes that we have, Gary, you've been vegan for almost 30 years.
Yes.
What led you to dedicate your life to animal rights and to the law? You're one of the pioneers of teaching animal rights at an American law school as well. How did all of this begin for you?
I went to a slaughterhouse in the 1970s, and it shook me out of my moral slumber when it, about this issue.
And was it somewhere around Richmond? Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. I was at the University of Virginia at the time, and I visited a slaughterhouse, and it opened my eyes and got me thinking. At the time, actually, Rebecca, I didn't know what a vegan was. I'd never heard the word vegan, and I was not aware that there were people who didn't eat any animal products whatsoever. And so I continued for a couple of, and as I say, there was no vegan movement back then. It was pretty stark out there. And so I stopped eating meat. I ate fish for a while until I read something that said fish felt pain. That's how dumb I was. And I didn't even think that, you know, I didn't think that fish felt pain. And I read some material that that fish felt pain, and I stopped eating fish. And then, as I learned about what happens with dairy animals and the production of all animal products, I simply stopped, and that was the end of it. And I realized, you know, and look, I still care very much about progressive issues, and I know a lot of your listeners do as well. And I hope that they'll think about, you know, a lot of my progressive friends say, you know, I'm into battered women, I'm into gay rights, I'm into this, I'm into that. That's great. Stay involved in those issues. Suffering is suffering. Justice is justice. Stay involved in your human rights issues. All you need to do to discharge your moral obligation to animals is you got to eat 3 times a day, whether you're a gay rights activist, whether you're a women's rights activist, whether you're, it doesn't matter what sort of active, peace activist, doesn't matter what you are. You got to eat 3 times a day, and you got to buy clothes. And so just stop eating them, wearing them, and using them, and you can incorporate the animal rights position into your life while you're still doing your progressive social causes. The problem is violence. Let's address the problem of violence, and let's, you know, embrace ahimsa, embrace peace, and embrace nonviolence. And the way you do that with respect to animals is you stop eating them, wearing them, and using them.
Gary Francione, thank you so much. And I hope that when the animal rights debate, abolition or regulation, comes out, that you'll come back on the show and let us talk about that in more depth.
You're going to have this big march coming up, I guess, in Virginia, this March for Farmed Animals. And one thing I would ask people to think about is the issue is not whether we're factory farming animals, which is the focus of that event. The issue is whether we should be eating animals at all. And I think it's a mistake for people to think that the issue is, you know, whether they're being raised in unpleasant circumstances. The problem is they're being raised at all. We should go vegan.
And I thank you so much for helping all of us think about that today. Gary Francione.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it, and I would love to come back.
Wonderful. On behalf of Jesse in the booth and Tim Duggan, my brilliant engineer and blog master, and all the other vital volunteers who make Indie Media Live possible, thank you all for listening today. If you missed any event announcements or phone numbers, if you'd like to comment on today's show or make suggestion for future shows, or if you'd like to hear this program again and again, go to our blog, indiemedialive.blogspot.com. Until next week, when my guests will be from one of the Commonwealth's greatest treasures, the Library of Virginia, be kind to yourself, be kind to the animals, be kind to the planet, but don't be silent, because silence is the voice of complicity. We wish you and the whole world peace.